Hello, everybody. Good morning. Everyone having a nice icy Saturday? Seemed to have missed out on all of the snow, but I'm sure everyone's plane was still canceled. So this is the Outside the Equation Exploring Alternative Forms of Mathematical Communications panel. I am your host, moderator. I'm a podcaster. I'm your host, Samuel Hansen. I am the producer and host behind the podcast Relatively Prime, which you can find at relprime.com. That is one of probably about 35 plugs I'll try to put into this panel because I want everybody to subscribe. If I see you on your smartphone, I'm going to assume that you're in your podcasting app. And with me today, I have Anna Hensch, Tim Chertier, and Robert Schneider, all of whom will now do a short introduction where they tell you a little bit about themselves and a little bit about their alternative form of mathematical communication. We are, of course, talking outside of, you know, your typical writing and lecturing communication, which is what most people do in order to communicate mathematics.
Thanks, Samuel. Thanks to everyone for being here this morning. So my name is Anna Hensch, and I am an assistant professor at Duquesne University, which is in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I host a podcast, and when I podcast, I always begin my podcast by saying that. And it's always the most difficult part of the podcast. I always have to say it like 12 times. Hello, my name is Anna Hensch. I'm an assistant professor at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It somehow is incredibly difficult, and then I start laughing in the middle.
Editor of her podcast, I will say that that's entirely true.
So I started podcasting about 2 years ago. And I do this podcast with my best friend who I met in graduate school. And we decided to do it because we were often talking on the phone for great lengths of time. And we realized that we would start to talk about math quite often, and not necessarily math in the like Galois theory sense, but math in the sense of like applying kind of mathematical logic to real life problems, or using this like kind of funny mathematical language to talk about relationships. Like when I'm saying, oh, I'm so mad at this person, I just hate them, and she would say, well, don't you think that maybe you're almost approaching the point at infinity, that perhaps you're going to love them soon? And it was just realizing we had these really rich, nice conversations. And then we thought, oh, we're enjoying them so much, we should record them so other people can enjoy them too. And then we had the good fortune of meeting Samuel, who thought we should do that as well. So we try to record as often as possible, but life being as it is, we're quite busy. So we have this podcast, it's called The Other Half. And the point of it is to talk about life just as such, and apply ideas of mathematics to life. So we've podcasted about the weather, traffic, kind of mundane things. And my favorite one by far was we did a podcast about racism and segregation and how you can understand the ill impacts of racism and segregation by looking at it through a mathematical framework. So it's in its essence, it's just conversations about life as you would have them with your best friend, but trying to understand them as a mathematician. And outside of blogging, outside of podcasting, I also write a blog for the American Mathematical Society.
And that is theotherhalf.acmescience.com if you also, say, want to subscribe to her podcast.
Great. I'm Tim Chartier, and there are probably several things that are rather untraditional about the way I communicate math, but probably the most dominant one is through movement, in particular mime. And movement is not solely something that I do. When my wife and I began to think about moving our professional mime training over into the venue of communicating mathematical ideas, we met with other people to try to begin to get a sense of how to wrap our minds around it. We met with Carl Schaefer, who's here in the audience, and he gave us many ideas about what to do. He pointed out a very valuable lesson that in the beginning we would probably choose to talk, which can sound like we failed mime class, but there is branches of mime where people talk. It's just not as dominant in the U.S., and generally you don't think they're doing mime, and they are. And he pointed out that in the beginning we would do more teaching in the speaking portion, and then in time we would move to not speaking. and it would become more like the artistry that we were doing at the time. And that's definitely been true, and we've woven in and out of that depending on the particular venue that we had. And then Art Benjamin had a lot of input. He continues to give input on ideas. So sometimes people wonder why, you know, why did we choose to merge mime and math? People have enough stigma with math that we decided to combine that with the stigma of mime. And so we just hoped that it was kind of a multiplicative thing where the negative and the negative became positive. And but one of the things that I think is true of that, of both of them, is that people often think that they don't like math. I don't like it at all. I have no good story to tell of math. I'm bringing my child, and I, you know, it's mime and math, so I'll sit here with my phone and do whatever while my child enjoys this. For a lot of people, when they experience math in a refreshing way, it truly is like getting a drink when you're completely parched. They've had a parched life in their mathematical experiences, and suddenly they don't. And through the art of mime and being visual, people are able to see that maybe the reason that you don't like math is because you haven't experienced the math that fits the way you think. Maybe you're a visual thinker. Maybe you would be good at math and topology, or maybe geometry that isn't high school geometry like you learned it. And it opens people up to hear things and see things in new ways, even if we're not teaching mathematics. Occasionally people will say, you're not doing math. I usually don't argue that, not simply because I'm a mime and don't want to, but that's just its own argument that's separate. To me, that's just showing that person's preference. But to say that it's not math, to me, is always an intriguing argument, because many of the ideas I use over and over again in class. In fact, half the show that we'll do today as part of, I don't know how to say it, the Mathematicon or whatever it's called, are sketches designed specifically for class. They were not designed for performance per se, and they became so in time. So for us, mime is a way of moving beyond the words so that people can enjoy and be introduced to the concepts themselves. And as is inherent in art, you can see what it is that you are open and ready to see, which sometimes I don't think we necessarily, we may in this room, but I think as at least a society, we sometimes think we're supposed to see what we're supposed to see. And math can be much richer than that. And mime is a venue that can underscore that there's that part of mathematics as well.
Hi there. My name's... Oh, that is on. I see. That's that sound. My name's Robert Schneider, and I'm a... Wait, this is perhaps...
Okay, no, yeah, I think...
I'm an engineer, too. Well, oh, yeah.
Switch is on the bottom.
I'm so sorry.
Here.
I just said I'm an audio
engineer.
Yeah,
if you hand it back, I can turn it on.
I'm self-taught audio engineer.
There we go.
I don't want to blow the speaker, but I believe that I could probably adjust that. Okay, yes. Oh, good.
Hello. Okay. Hi, guys. My name is Robert Schneider, and I'm a graduate student in number theory at Emory University here in Atlanta. I came to mathematics from being a musician. I've been a musician and a record producer and a composer for my most of my adult life up until a few years ago when I went to graduate school. I dropped out of college when I was about 20 as a senior in philosophy, and at that time I had never taken a college-level math class. I started to take those when I was in my late 30s. But luckily I was already a senior, so that was convenient. For me, I see mathematics and music as being very similar. Obviously there's a lot of mathematical components to music and to the theory of acoustics that are incredibly interesting on their own, and also theoretically interesting to music theory. But, it's like, who are we as people? We're like minds, and we think things and we feel things and we feel a need to communicate these things. And we want to transfer our thoughts to other people and we want to get those thoughts back. And like visual art or music, mathematics is sort of a nonverbal language that expresses ideas and emotions, just like language does, but it expresses them in a different way and in a fairly subtle way. And in mathematics, much like music theory, there's a terse language that's incredibly more varied than music theory. That sort of, allows you to represent on paper your ideas, but those aren't the real ideas. the ideas are these huge things that are hovering around the paper, just like a symphony hovers around the score. And my interest in expressing mathematics through music is not coming from the perspective of a mathematician, because I come to mathematics from the arts. For me, it's a creative sort of enjoyable act, as it is for everybody. I mean, obviously, but that's my interest in it is mainly in that, as opposed to its usefulness or its truth. To me, it's about beauty and sort of mystery, like art. And for me as a composer in music, I am interested in exploring different sounds and combinations and patterns that haven't been heard before. Our brains and our ears and physical objects resonate readily with, for instance, the chromatic scales, things, you know, Pythagoras basically discovered music theory as we understand it, you know, in its simplest form. And, but yet, there are so many possibilities with sound, of ways to combine sounds and to express feelings through them. And so my interest, I suppose, in using mathematics is in composing, using patterns and ideas that haven't been heard before, that might create new brain, you know, neural connections and maybe new ideas in the listener, and that can allow me as a composer to feel different feelings that I haven't felt before, and then to try to stimulate those in listeners. So I guess for me, I love to use mathematics and try to find ideas in math to kind of, I don't know, explore and then transmit these different ideas and sounds. For example, I kind of came into the math community exactly 10 years ago because I was invited to speak at MathFest in, I think it was in San Jose, California. Anyway, I was on tour in Europe with my band, and I had that year sort of been experimenting with a musical scale based on logarithms. You can basically just tune the notes of the scale to the logarithms of whole numbers. The notes get closer together as the logarithms do. But due to the special properties of logarithms, the log of x, y equals log x plus log y, and so on, I had realized that there are things in music called beat frequencies that I don't necessarily need to go into right now, but these are aspects of the timbre of sounds that we hear when we play chords or when we strike instruments. And these beat frequencies, when you use logarithms to tune your scale to when you tune your musical scale to logarithms, the chords when you play them produce beat frequencies that are also connected by the properties of logarithms to the scale you're playing. They're not these random sorts of like overtones or, I mean, like random timbres and stuff. There's a really weird organized sound that happens when you play chords with notes that are tuned to logarithms. If you look at it on an oscilloscope, for instance, you play a tone, and on an oscilloscope you'll see a you know, sort of a vibration. If you play two tones, that vibration becomes more organized. And with the logarithmic scale, if you play two or three tones together, for instance, I found a very nice chord, and I was in a studio, so there was an oscilloscope at hand. You don't usually carry one. Or wait, I guess you do. And I played a chord, and as I played one note, it was like oscillations. As I played the second note, it turned into a circle, which wasn't surprising because oscilloscopes track phase and stuff. When I played the third note, there was suddenly this three-dimensional knot that appeared on this oscilloscope. I mean, it looked like crazy, like 1980s, you know, vector computer graphics from some, you know, awesome Atari game or something. Like, and not only did it form a beautiful knot shape, but the knot was rotating in three dimensions on the oscilloscope screen. It was a beautiful, amazing shape that came because the logarithmic properties of the chord canceled out all of the stray overtones and stuff like that. And there was just this beautiful shape left that was tracked on the screen. Anyway, this was a beautiful experience for me. And in general, I think it's interesting and fun and beautiful to explore different sounds and different feelings. And mathematics has this whole library. It's not even a library, it's a universe of patterns that are not really accessible through any other means but going into the universe. You know, you can't just like look into mathematics and really get what's going on. You do it, just like, you know, you feel it and you manipulate it and you interact with it. And I think you can bring those through other media and in at least a small way allow those ideas to resonate with others by using the arts and literature and other media to express mathematical ideas. And so to me as an artist, and I think for artists in general, it's a rich like catalog of patterns and new feelings that can be expressed to the public and to the listener and to our friends and just, you know, even for ourselves. And that's my interest in mathematics crossed with music. And I've experimented in other ways too, but it's like that, I think that, I hope that that is okay.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah, I think you're good, Robert.
Thank you, Samuel.
One of the things I usually wonder about when talking about these alternative forms is the sort of different reactions that we get with these alternative forms versus the reactions we get when we're, say, writing an article or giving a talk. Does anyone have an example of where they got a pretty different reaction from their audience because of this different way that they are communicating, or maybe they're able to communicate to a different group of people than we normally would when we're just, you know, up there giving a, you know, fun math talk?
Well, I'm going to tell a funny story, and then that'll give the other panelists the time to think. This answered what I thought you were asking until you finished it. So,
it's as long as it's a more interesting question than the one I actually asked, it's fine.
So, because it's mime and math, the introductions can be quite intriguing when people decide to introduce the show. And I was invited to a particular school, and they typically would get 100 people at that type of venue. But because this was mimatics, as we call it, they decided to invite and push it in the radio to the whole community. So schools showed up, and the entire auditorium was packed with 350 people in the seating, and all the walls lined up. And so the person who had organized it was like almost intoxicated with, you know, just the experience of having that many people there. And so when he got up, I think, like, if you see students do this, where you see their mind go blank, and he was walked up to the microphone, saw all the faces, and then I saw his mind just go, and it was like, oh no, you know, I don't know what's going to come out now. So he said, you know, we've never seen Tim Chartier do any of what he's about to do, but we figured anyone who was bold enough to do mime and math together, we just had to see. Let's welcome Tim Chartier. And so I do a lot of performing with my wife, and we were, I alluded to this earlier, we were doing professional performing prior to the mimatics that people see now, and we have trained with Marcel Marceau and so forth, and so we're doing it very seriously, and that's fine. I mean, there are many hills you climb when in performing that you just get used to, but when I told Tanya the story, she said, "My goodness, what did you do?" And I laughed, and I said, "What do you think I would do?" And Tanya said, "You went up there, and for 10 minutes, you basically did almost stand-up comedy to get them, we call it in the room, to get them in the room." And I said, "Yes." And even worse, I learned later that 50 of these people out there were required to be there by their teacher, which I could see because there was this group that were sitting together with their arms crossed. And then he gave that introduction, and then their shoulders got tight. And I thought, oh my goodness, I don't know how I'm going to get them in. So what I did was there's many ways to do mime where it's almost like you're your own prop, but almost like prop comedy. And you just do funny things for people. And I was doing all that. And then suddenly, if this makes any sense, the room relaxed, people were there. And then I could say, now let's talk about mime and math. And people stayed in the moment. And then we had a delightful time. It was just a delightful show. But sometimes, because it's alternative, it's in itself unknown. And so there's that unknown factor that example was just the introduction. Other times it has nothing to do with the introduction. It's just the nature of the art itself is that we always think, what's the first thing we're doing? Because we don't know what the room will be like. So I'm sure it's different in other contexts, but for us, we're always having to think that because we don't know what we're going to face with. Like if it's an elementary school group, K to two, then it's no problem. I mean, you just have to be fun in the first 10 seconds and then you're set, so.
I guess I face similar experiences of kind of putting out this product and people have a preconceived notion of what it's going to be, like mathematical content is going to be dull. Oh, it's not for me. You're pairing it with miming. I'm pairing it with audio, which doesn't seem to sit well with math. So you are up against this wall of like, oh no, that's not for me. But it's been such a really fun experience to release this product and have people like it who had no idea that they would. So the number of people who have listened to our podcast and come back to me and say, that's math. I didn't know that was math. Because we're kind of talking about things that you would talk about anyways. And people have this idea that math is equations and you know, numbers and this kind of dull stuff, quadratic formulas, and not things that you would ever see in your life. So just having a casual conversation with your girlfriend about this or that, and then suddenly realizing 20 minutes later, oh, we've been talking about math the whole time. It's really nice. So it's been fun to, particularly people who I know who have this like extreme math aversion, to show it to them and have them come back and say, oh, I really like that. That's math. Oh, well, I guess I like math then. Okay. It's really nice. So that's been my favorite thing. I think that answers your question.
Yeah.
I think, so the mathematical aspect of music that I've worked on is on an incredibly obscure scale. It's not like a lot of people hear it. I'm not going to lectures or things like that and playing music based on logarithms or things like that. So I think I need to speak in a slightly larger sense about the effect of mathematics and music on people that I've observed outside of my own. Because we're talking like me sitting with two friends and like playing some chords and them going, oh, it makes my stomach feel kind of funny or something like that. You know, it's not like a public response. And that happened. So sound waves naturally resonate in mathematics, and there's a lot of number theory in there and stuff. And so just, for instance, there's a composer named Lamont Young, and Lamont Young is a mid-20th century composer. He's currently a composer, but he started composing in the mid-20th century. He has an amazing exhibition that's always open in New York City called the Dream House, by the way, and I encourage anybody that's local to there to go to this amazing, enlightening installation. But anyway, Lamont Young, his composition, The Dream House, well, his philosophy is that sound evolves over time in the air and in space and in the listener. And sounds should be extended for a period of time to allow you to really taste them or whatever. And so let them soak in. And so he writes about this stuff and he talks about how music is just chopping the sound up into all these little islands of sound and taking away the most beautiful property of it. He's basically saying like rhythm and melody are bad, and like, which is like crazy. I mean, it's not crazy. It's really, really just different and futuristic. So anyway, his composition is a chord of about 37 or 38 sine waves that are all co-primed to each other in wavelength. And they're tuned to prime numbered wavelengths in some way, and or maybe what prime numbered frequencies actually. And because of that, he sets up these standing waves in the room, and the standing waves give a spatialization to the sound. You can walk through it and feel the sound in your body, and the sound is different at every point in space due to the coprimality of all of the waveforms that are bouncing around in the room. He sets it up in a very scientific, acoustically optimized way. Some people hate this. I mean, how could you not hate it if you walk into a room? It sounds like you're inside a machine suddenly. I think most people, however, if you just didn't run out right away, would be, it sinks in, and there's this profound effect that really does make you appreciate the extended tones that the composer's into. But very few people would listen to something like this. On the other hand, like Bach used mathematical structures in his compositions with great effect and with great popularity. So it's not like it always turns people off. I think it depends on how well it fits into the current kind of, you know, just the vibe of your time. And also I think, on the other hand, you have a composer like Xenakis, who is an orchestral composer in the 20th century, who turned to music from mathematics and architecture. His compositions are fairly popular and highly influential in classical music, but you're certainly not like hearing them at Christmas time. They sound like, you know, an army of like groaning, kind of like maybe like if a whole zoo decided to sing at once or something. His scores look like geometric diagrams all over a page, and at the end of every line it says cello or, you know, clarinet 2. It's like the musician is supposed to look at the sprawling drawing. It looks like an architectural diagram, but it's highly abstract, and play it as a score. He's sort of like what I would consider to be in the middle of upsetting people's stomachs. Although when ideas like this have been introduced into music, it's famously so that the audiences, at least upon the first listening, will hate it. So I think that expressing mathematics in music, the farther you go from the standard music of your time, in any direction, never mind mathematical, people are less likely to listen to it. So I don't see that, say, for instance, putting math into music is extremely different from doing experimental music or noise or free jazz or something like that. On the other hand, if you get into it in the right mindset and you're following the composer, like Lamont Young's installation, you have the opportunity to tune into this different idea and to really feel it in a different way. And I think that when people do that and they take the time to do it, it really does resonate. You don't have to understand the mathematics to feel the mathematics in a musical way. I guess that is, does that that's address that well enough? I mean, like, it's just like, my only experiences have been on a really small scale because I've released this music on a wide scale, but it's not like it's a fairly minor, it's extremely esoteric, you know? I'm sure people hit skip on the CD to the next song. or hopefully they don't.
Tim, I wanted to circle back for just a second. You had mentioned that you had been doing the, you know, more traditional mime performance before you started doing Mimematics. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about sort of the audience reaction difference between the more traditional versus when you're doing the more mathematical. Or if there is one, like how you can kind of see, or is it just mostly that the audiences are actually made up of different people?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not sure, so I'm going to, again, say something else, and then I'll circle back to that to give my mind a moment. One of the most interesting differences between doing mime and math and doing mime strictly on its own accord is that when we do the mime just as its own art form, we do whatever we want to do. We perform things that we think up, and then we perform them. One of the most interesting things about Mimematics is that we want it to hold for the artists in our life, that there was this period of time where no one knew that I was studying math at all. When I taught and performed in international performing arts conferences, even when we performed for Marceau, he thought we were full-time performers. Nobody knew. It wasn't like I was hiding it, but they're rather generally math-phobic folks, so it's not necessarily something I want to go and have a discussion about either, so we just didn't talk about it. And then, so I want them to come and see the Tim and Tanya that they know, if that makes any sense, the artists that they know, that we didn't just, like, change what we do because we got to figure out a way to do it with math. That just doesn't sit right with us. But then on the other end, I want a mathematician who knows me only as a mathematician, and when I say that I'm a professionally trained mime, goes, what? Yeah, you are rather lyrical in the way you move. They don't say it like that, but you need both. It needs to be mathematically correct, which to the artist is not necessarily the case. I've had many of my artistic friends go, well, why don't you just do that? It'd be great. And I'm like, because it's mathematically wrong. And they're like, so? And I'm like, no. I mean, if the sketch is about being mathematically wrong, that's fine. But I'm not going to the JMM and doing that. So, I mean, and then on the math side, it's like, I've got the best idea for you. Okay. And they share it. And Tanya and I use the language, it's not mimeable, at least yet. That's cool. But, I mean, I don't really know how people be watching for very long. I mean, you would. But, I mean, I don't know how to make it. Mime is supposed to extend beyond the words. In a musical, people sing because they'd never say that. Their emotion is so elevated that they're now singing. Mime is supposed to be that you actually don't realize we're not speaking, except at the beginning because you're not used to that experience. But once you just sink slightly in, you don't notice that we're not playing charades. You're not trying to guess what I'm trying to say. This is the only way I'd say it. As Marceau would say, if you said anything, the experience would be less. And that's what you're shooting for. Well, we have that in math, where we write or we look or there's those moments beyond words that the prof may say something, but none of us are listening because of those profound moments, the moments that we see that knot, that three-dimensional knot, go on the screen. There are, for me too, it was the artistry of math that pulled me in. I was definitely not a math major. It was my backup. And then I hit mathematical proofs. And it was the day that there were two sizes of infinity, let alone what came after that. That was the day I went, wait a minute, this has a place for me. Because up to then, I kept assuming one of these days, I'm tapping out. I don't know why, but I'm just so different. And I said to someone last night, I was way more artistic in my general just way of behaving than I am now. And the person went, really? And Tanya went, oh yeah. And in terms of where that is, in terms of, because of the reason that came to mind with your question, Samuel, is that in that sense, mimetics isn't that different from what we did before. However, there are versions of mime that I've yet to figure out how to put in to mimetics. I can't, it drives me nuts because we'll do our normal performing and these rich sets of mime come out that we perform. And people who come to that who know mimetics go, man, you should do that with mime and math. It's like, I know, but I don't know what mathematical idea to do. I can't wrap my head around it yet. Or I know what it is, but I don't know if I can adhere to the math while I'm doing it because it's so artistic that I haven't gotten my brain to think that, if that makes any sense. Like, I'll just start being, I'll take too much artistic license with it at this particular time. So it takes time for those things. The ideas grow, and these are in infant stages, and some of them will be infants forever. They don't have to grow up, and others will stay there. In terms of the composition of the audience, I would say the biggest thing is that what I like about mimetics that I never thought about when we did it, I'm not sure I thought anything. I just did it because I wanted to perform for local schools and have it count for service for the college because I was doing so much performing. I mean, it's a really silly reason, but I never thought anyone else would want to see it. I knew schools would, but I didn't. That's all I wanted to do. But the thing that I love is when we go to particularly universities and you have professors sitting with their families, particularly the children who are not the math lovers, and they sit and they point and they talk and they giggle and they share, even though it's like a Pixar film, not that I'm at the level of Pixar, but like in Pixar, where you're both laughing, but not necessarily at the same thing, and yet at the same thing. And when that happens, for me, that's a very special thing, because I think that that is definitely there in mathematics. And when we can do that, it's very special. Just like last night at Colin Adams' performance, where my daughter would turn, she's 10, and would be laughing at this sketch that I'm laughing at because I'm a professor. And she's laughing at because I don't know why. I'm thinking, why is that funny? You know what I mean? But it doesn't matter because it transcends both of us at this other part. And that's what makes podcasts beautiful. That's what makes music beautiful, because those experiences are so different than what I do that allows me to enter math for myself in a new way as well. So it answers what you're asking, but that's the kind of the best I can do, because otherwise I don't feel like I'm doing something different, which I was definitely afraid of in the beginning. I was like, I will not do much of this because I will no longer be an artist and I can't do that. And now I do basically, mimetics is most of my performing and it doesn't bother me. Where in the beginning, if you had told me that, I would have stopped doing it because I would have been like, oh my gosh, that'd be horrible. And so, which it shows my own preconceived notion of what I do, but anyway.
There's something in there that actually directly relates to a question I had written down in my notebook, which is this idea of the importance of perfect math versus public engagement. So in order to give something the mathematically perfect definition or theorem or something like that can oftentimes include all of this language and things that a lot of people don't necessarily have. And so there's that perfect from the book version of math. And then there's the version that you can give to the public that will let them understand almost all of it, but not necessarily all of it. And I was wondering if y'all could talk a little bit about how you will approach taking one of those harder problems and, you know, modifying it just enough that you feel mathematically comfortable using it, but not necessarily, that it's not necessarily the whole thing.
I can begin with a brief anecdote. I was the AAAS Mass Media Fellow in 2013, and I was working at the science desk at National Public Radio in Washington, D.C., which was fantastic. And while I was there, I was kind of a mathematical quality control consultant to science stories. So people would have me like double check their arithmetic on their science stories. And occasionally I was able to write a mathematical story for the air. This happened very, very rarely. And I was always really excited when I got to write a math story for the air because there are so precious few mathematical stories on the radio. I mean, it's possible that maybe you've never heard one. I would say there's maybe one a year. So I was so excited when I was asked to write a story that was somehow loosely related to the Poincaré conjecture. Of course, I had to make this palatable to a radio audience. I had to kind of buff down the edges to make it something that you can talk about without any visual aids and that people aren't just gonna tune out immediately. So I wrote some little story about holes in things and surfaces and this and that. And it was maybe a 45 second spot on All Things Considered. And I was really excited about it. I wrote it with Joe Palca, who's a fantastic science journalist. And I felt like I was doing the right thing for my profession, somehow getting math on the air. And I was just really amped about it. It went up that evening, on the commute home time, whenever All Things Considered is on. And the next day, I came into work to heaps of hate mail from mathematicians, which boggled my mind. Heaps, not heaps, but at least 5 emails had been sent to the editor on my desk saying that I had inaccurately represented the Poincaré conjecture, and you forgot this part, and you didn't mention the higher dimensional this and that. And it just made me so mystified when I thought, like, here I am, a mathematician, putting math on the air for you, and it's exactly the mathematicians who are kind of wagging their finger at me. So this has been something that I took that to heart, and I think about it often when I'm when I was working at NPR, now when I podcast, and when I write my blog, about where it's safe to kind of file down the edges and where it's not. And I wish that as a community somehow, we could be a little bit more understanding of what it takes to bring math to the people. That as a community, you can't give a fully formulated theorem with supporting technical lemmas and multi-page hypotheses and expect anyone to care. They simply won't. I know we do, but we're good like that. So that's just something that I think about, and I don't like to call it lying, but in my mind I do. I think, is it okay for me to lie on this? Is it okay for me to kind of just file down the edge just a little bit, just so it's a little easier to swallow. And it's a delicate thing, but something I give a great deal of thought to.
I had a pretty similar experience. I got a STEM story grant from PRX to produce a story about the Quaternions Walk out in Ireland every October 19th. I want to say there's a walk in honor of Roan Hamilton and the day that he had his epiphany about quaternions. And I'd gone over there, I'd gotten some tape, and I was back and I was doing the writing for the story, you know, the narration. If you've never had to produce a radio story, there's a tremendous amount of writing involved and then going back and forth with editors. And this was a feature length story, so it was about 10 minutes. And I had the biggest problem with not my main editor. My main editor was amazing, but the editor above her was a little bit more problematic and demanded that I not use the words number system without defining them. And I thought that was just a step too far for me. It's like this number system, and it's like, well, no one's going to know what that. There's this fear where you had a bunch of mathematicians angry at you. I had an editor angry because they were afraid that they were going to get a bunch of complaints about not understanding. And so that was another thing where I just want to push back. Like, most people are going to be okay with this. Like, if it was a biologist doing a story or a chemistry story, you'd be able to say the word cell right? Without going down and describing every single level of what a cell is and made up of, and is made up of. And so I felt that in some ways, mathematics, there's this assumption that people won't understand any of it. So you have to go down to the most elementary version of it, which is essentially the opposite problem that you had, but I thought was still a little bit illustrative.
It's a delicate balance.
It's funny, because we do mimes, so we forget to say everything. So we don't really run into that. I mean, like, it's interesting. It's different the way we run into it, but I guess that's why people will say we don't do math. And I'm an applied mathematician, so I get that anyway. So it doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to me which way that comes. I mean, there's no way that can be a new argument in my life. So it just isn't something I worry about. Really quickly, just because of the way that was very helpful to hear the filing analogy. And I was thinking, how do I think of that? There are two ways I think about it. One is, so when you teach calculus, are you really going to teach a Calc 1 student real analysis in terms of the functional analysis of what they're doing? No. So then, what do you expect me to do on stage? Like, and you might expect me to do something else, but I'm not going to. So I see it that way, is that there's a part of public communication of mathematics that is teaching. And whether you're teaching it for them, it's not teaching for them to understand necessarily, it's teaching them to experience. And I even see teaching that way. The real integration and understanding of the topic is done without me involved. Maybe I'm involved some, but my part is to give you moments to hang on to. That those moments are the moments that you hang on to when it's hard or you're frustrated or you're confused. And those give those either motivation or opening of understanding for you. Is that, you know, maybe there are moments where I'm, you know, I say it in a way that you then have a moment of permanent understanding. But I don't know. I mean, that's asking, I don't know, maybe. But a lot of times for all the people in the room to expect that to occur in this moment, I don't know. I don't even see performing that way. It's just there's a communication going on. We communicate, so we're both talk. Sometimes the talking is going on in your head and so forth. But the other way that I look at performing is that when you are trying to demonstrate a particular idea, I see that as a mathematical model of the mathematical idea. It's a simplification of the idea. So I will make simplifying assumptions on the idea, and I'll show you a model of it. What's a model? The purpose of a model is to capture the essence of what you're modeling. Can I capture some essence of what I'm doing? And for as a mime, that's very much what we do, is that if you have a butterfly flying through the air and then it takes off, I mean, is that really a butterfly? No, that's not. I mean, that's ridiculous. But they're like when you button a coat, Marceau would do that all the time. He'd button a coat. That's how you button a coat. That's ridiculous. You can't. What button do you have that does that? But introductory mime students will do it like a real button and then go to the next. It's like, what are you doing? Unless this is a sketch entitled The Details of Buttoning a Coat. It's not the point. That's not what you're doing. And so you always simplify. You always simplify, simplify, simplify is what we do. Make it simple. And I also do puppetry. I've just never merged that into the math. Is that in puppetry, we always say, you simplify until you think if you simplify anymore, the message is gone. And so that's the way I look at communicating the idea of what we're doing. And because it's art to me, will you see it? I'm not as interested in necessarily exactly. If I need you to see something, then I probably need to say something. Because saying it is different than the art of mime. I cannot get myself to perform mime in a way where I think that you must see this exact thing or you're not experiencing what you should be experiencing. That makes no sense to me. So that if you see something and you come up and tell me what you saw and I think, whoa, then I actually enjoy hearing what that is. But people will experience it in different ways. And to me, again, that's teaching because people experience the classroom, the content. Like, you know, they're not understanding this. They are, just not what they're not in the way that they're understanding it in a way, just not necessarily the way that we want if it's content that they're, you know, their specific way that we need them to look at it. So anyway, those are the kind of, that's a really helpful question. And it was really helpful to hear the way you talked about that. I'll be very interested in yours because it's just, it's very interesting to me the way that the music aligns. And for what it's, just to point this out, when you pointed out that you do it in small groups, our mime is often created in small groups. We don't unveil the mime for a large audience. Is that we'll just like, can you watch this? And then we'll show it to people. And so it's different, and I realize that. But it was when you said, you know, it makes, you know, that made my stomach, I was thinking going a knot, which I thought was funny because I think you used a different term, but I was thinking knot. And, but we'll show it to people. And if somebody just goes, huh? It's like, okay, yeah, that didn't work. You know what I mean? And so we'll try that. So, and I imagine like yours had an element of that. I was interested with the way that you were just talking with your friend and then the podcasting emerged out of that. Our mime and math emerged out of what we were doing. There was a naturalness to it and there were elements of that. That one of the things we often say in a show is that mime is just our communication style. This is the way we communicate math. If that's been special for you, what is your way? What are your interests? Find that, and that may be the connection that can either deepen your experience with math or give you the experience that maybe you didn't even know you were searching for. And so that's often the way we talk about it. It's interesting to me that we each have had that journey in our own ways, given the things that we do that, for me at least, are really refreshing even now. Even if I'm not listening specifically to your podcast, I mean, I know your work, but it's interesting.
You're both really amazing public speakers. that's really interesting. Those are very deep comments. My small underground music, obscure mathematical explorations, I think, are not the best venue to answer the question. I think that, Samuel, what you said, I think that maybe it's fair on the part of the editor, while a little absurd and hilarious. And I also think that it's really unfair that a bunch of mathematicians wrote about your story, because if you want to read the news story about that result, you have to read the paper. That is the news article that contains all the details. It's not like, you know, something coming off of The Wire and it's got all the details in it and you have some standard journalistic way to write it. It's like, seriously, like, if you want to read the story, you have to read the article. And that is the news story. All you're doing is giving the headline, basically. And the headline for a math story happens to be 45 seconds long. It's a really long headline. But, it's a long article, presumably. I think that part of the issue is that if you have an idea you want to express to somebody, you have to talk to them in their language. You can't like go up to somebody that speaks Spanish and start speaking German to them, given that you had that skill. And I think that no matter how deeply you feel the idea, you have to speak it in the way that the person's going to understand it. And so I think that what you call lying, and I think that the form of expressing without words is very, very, it's a very beautiful and compact way to do it. But I think that that's, you know, it's appropriate because we all learn a little math, you know, like we're like little kids and we learn to write and draw and we learn a little about music and we learn a little about math. And maybe some people go on and they're poets with their language skills or they're artists with their drawing that they learned or they become musicians having learned to play the xylophone or whatever as a child, you know, but far fewer people go on and do mathematics just as a hobby. There's not a venue for it. Like, it's not like you can like join the math group at your church or something like that. Like you can join the choir. You know what I mean? It's like it's a rarefied but still comparable medium. You know, and it's something we all learn as children. But our skills stop with mathematics. Our skills stop where it's useful. You stop learning math at the point that it gets more esoteric. Most people do, I mean. So that's why there's this misconception about math. Oh, well, you know, it's just this boring, useful stuff. Well, yeah, it is boring and useful, just like when you learn grammar. It's just that you mastered grammar way earlier and you're able to start reading literature in middle school. You know, in mathematics, you can't read literature until you get into, say, your sophomore year of college or something, unless you're really, really motivated. And so you don't have the exposure to these bigger ideas because you stop learning at the point. It's as if you, like, stopped learning about poetry because you didn't like learning grammar. And I think that, I'm not trying to argue the point, all I'm saying is that most people are able to go into poetry and go into art to some degree and go into things like music in their schools or their orchestras or their churches or rock bands. And most people aren't able to push through at the right age to get into the comparable kind of realm of mathematics that's more like literature or playing music or something. And so for me, I feel that it's important, but that language is there in everybody. Everybody has the same very basic childhood skills in math and art and language and music and so on. You can talk to anybody about these subjects if you're able to fuse them into, you know, if you're able to allow those memories and those early experiences and those early lessons to resonate. And so I think that in math, the wrong way to go about it is, I mean, no, I'm not saying the wrong way. I can't say that. There's no wrong way to do anything. I'm just saying that in math, it's not a successful way probably to talk to the public unless you're able to speak a language that will resonate with the most people. And so I think that being able to pull in public performance and to pull in humor and to pull in storytelling and to tie it to art, not just to make art like Mark, but to actually just even just be able to tie, just to talk about it in a way that people can be like, oh, I get that. You can be like, okay, well, the math is really abstract, but, you know, think about cubism. You know, and it's kind of like that. Cubism doesn't look like the thing they're painting, but it's beautiful because of just the shapes, and math's like that. Or, I mean, I'm just trying to say that I feel that it's important to address people in the language they speak, and most people share a basic language in the arts as well as in math. And I think that these all tie together in early memories, and you can stimulate the math feeling by stimulating the other feelings around them. So if you talk about history and stories and, you know, music and things like that, I think that that helps prime the mathematical sort of ideas to kind of emerge in people that where they have kind of become dormant. And I guess that that's so. For me, even in writing a math paper, it would be nice to have a math paper where at least like the first two sentences your mom could read and be like, oh, that was nice, or something like that. You know what I mean? It was nice, and then I didn't understand it. But like, you know, I think it's good to try to be friendly and to try to stimulate the more sensory sorts of memories and feelings in people when you can. And I would think that that is why the mathematicians were off base, because you were doing the right thing. But your editor was maybe on base because you might have been dipping into a language that even a professional editor didn't understand. Then how will the listener? I'm not saying it was right. I mean, obviously, I'm just saying that.
Oh yeah, it was. I mean, part of my feeling was that trying to explain quaternions in a way that every person is going to at least have a basic understanding of them is mildly problematic.
Yeah, exactly.
And like that was my line in the sand. Like I've filed down every single edge until this is essentially a plane.
Yeah, you're totally right.
And so I'm not going to make it a point. I'm going to keep it a plane. I'm not going to make it a point, and that's where that is the hill I'm going to die on.
And you're right, because number system, those are both very primitive words that we all understand. And if you say them together, I get it. Well, I mean, yeah, but I'm a PhD student. But I'm just saying, if you say, okay, like, let's say you say something like sculpture machine. That's not a thing, but as soon as I say it, you get a feeling for what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You say number system, I get a feeling for what it means, because you're putting together two words that really mean something specific. So I think probably maybe it was off base. And also the thing is that as a podcaster, you're an artist. And as a writer and a journalist, you're an artist, as well as a mathematician and an artist. You know, I think that there's some poetic license to being able to tell the story the way you need to tell it. So I guess I take back my. I'm just on the fence about it. That's all.
No. I fully understand. Before I ask the next question, everyone here has probably seen that there's some sort of weird thing next to Robert over there, and we haven't had a chance to hear it yet. So he does have a marimba.
Yes. Okay. So So I had mentioned earlier about the musical scale tuned to logarithms, and I have like this marimba, which is an African thumb piano. It's the other name for it. It's an instrument. It's really hard to a musical scale that's tuned to a mathematical sequence isn't like it doesn't line up with any of the normal notes, right? The intervals are different. You can't it's not like you can pick out a subset of notes on the piano and play the scale that when it's an alternative scale. That makes it really hard to compose or play for it. I mean, it's really like I used a sine wave generator, literally a tone generator to generate tones for my compositions, because that was the only way I could think to do it. I think there are other, for instance, stringed instruments like violins and cellos, they can play an arbitrary sequence of tones. But I mean, like, then how are you going to train the musician to hear those tones and to be able to play them? So there are a few instruments that it's easy to use to play an alternative scale. And in any event, the thumb piano is a really great one. It's simple, it's easy to get, and you can like slide these little bars. It makes a sound. It makes a sonorous, non-clunky sound. I'm joking. But like, but you can slide the little bars back and forth and to tune them. So I took my tone generator and I tuned each bar and I made little pencil marks on them where they needed to line up when they inevitably fall out of place. And so I can like compose kind of just sitting around if I want to in this musical scale on my thumb piano. And I had a composition I wrote last year while I was on the beach, but I don't think I can remember it, but I'm going to try to remember a few chords of it. But also I'm just going to play through the scale so you can hear what I mean when I talk about a scale that's an alternative scale. Is that cool? Okay. This isn't like it's going to sound awesome. It's going to sound terrible. I'm not saying the scale's terrible, but it's going to sound terrible to you on this thumb piano. So this is the one octave of a scale that's tuned to logarithms. It starts at log 4, log 5, and so on. And these are the frequencies that are tuned to that, okay? So the notes get closer together because the logarithms get closer together. I think I can do this. Are you sure?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I'll face it that way. The thumb piano goes alternatively, so it's like 1, 2, 3, and so on. So it alternates, and I need to get my thumbs ready. So those notes, it starts out sounding kind of similar to the regular scale. Kind of starts to go off because the logarithms are spaced quite nicely at the bottom of the scale. They sound musical, even by our standard feeling for music. But at the top of the scale, you get sequences like this. They're almost microtonal, these are tones that are much closer together than what we normally hear in a musical scale. Our brain, when you hear something like this, your brain just like, it stretches. It wants those notes to get pushed up to the ones that you're used to hearing. You know, those notes, they're not just vibrations in the air. I mean, our like brains actually fire off, our neurons fire off at the rates that we hear these notes. They want to hear, your brain wants to hear the notes sound right, okay? But they don't. It's a different kind of scale. The first time I played it, when I was able to transfer it to a synthesizer keyboard, it was the weirdest experience because I'm so used to the keyboard sequence of notes as a musician and a songwriter. And when I played it, it was like, you know, I said to my wife the first time I tried it, it's like my mother turned around and spoke to me with a man's voice. It was so shocking and strange, you know? And like, and it really felt, and, but in any event, you can pick out subsets of the scale where there are these beautiful harmonies that are, in a sense, they're more sonorous than the standard harmonies because their overtones and their timbres are also part of the scale, which isn't possible with a standard tuning. For instance, I'm going to try to pick out a few chords. Let's see. Okay, that doesn't go very well. Notice how if I change from this chord to this chord, there's hardly any difference in the notes. For instance, this note to this note, they're very close together, or this note to this note. They're almost the same, right? Now, but hear it in a chord. That sounds bad. Okay, that one sounded pretty bad too, actually. Let's find a nice one. That sounds pretty nice. Now let's try the one that's right next to it. I mean, it's almost the same note. It sounds kind of sour or something like that, and they're just right next to each other, but you hear this ugliness or this niceness. The niceness when you can get it, it's very, very nice. That's a chord you've never heard before, I presume. But then something like this, that's a chord you don't want to ever hear again, probably. So, you know, there's some art to trying to compose it a new scale, but some of those were nice, some of them weren't. I was just improvising there. But speaking of free jazz, well, I don't think that is good enough to be considered to be either free or jazz. But anyway, I'm sorry that I don't have a well-practiced composition to play, but it's really hard to compose and play in alternate scales and then later remember what you did because you're not used to like thinking about it. Anyway, that's an example of building and playing an alternative musical scale. If you're a musician, I encourage you to mess around with it sometimes. If you have access to an instrument that you can retune, even if you're a guitar player, there are weird tunings you can mess with. It just stretches your brain in a really cool way to just like looking at, imagine the first time somebody saw a completely abstract painting compared to say, even Impressionism or something that resembles real life. It's kind of like, it's gotta be shocking, but then at the same time, children make abstract art all the time. So it's not totally shocking. And also children make, in their orchestras, abstract music all the time. I'm on my thing. And so it doesn't take you too long to get used to it. Oh, yeah, the recorders, that's awesome. Anyway, yes, thank you. Thank you, Samuel, for having me on your panel, and thank you all for your amazing comments. That was really beautiful.
You're very welcome. I have one last question, and depending on how long everyone's answers are, we might be able to get one or two from y'all. And that is, when have you failed with your alternative communication style?
I can answer that. Coming from the arts, my alternative communication style is mathematics. And I'm in graduate school. And so I'm just hoping that failure is not ahead of me. So that's...
I feel like it's hard to pinpoint one time.
because everything has gone off so well, or because there's been so many failures?
Well, I feel like the good ones really stand out, and then the bad ones you just kind of repress.
So before Relatively Prime, before Math Mass, before Strong Connected Components, I've had a lot of math podcasts. The first one was one called Combinations and Permutations, which don't go listen to, unless you want a bunch of really bad off-color jokes and swearing with a small amount of mathematics. But I had the really good idea. And this was just a panel show where it's me and some other grad students, you know, it was a very typical early generation podcast. Just a bunch of mostly white guys sitting around a table with microphones. And I decided, like, you know what? One time, we're going to talk about chaos. We're going to talk about chaos. This is going to be clearly a good idea. It was a terrible idea. Trying to communicate chaos in only a panel style with no visuals on audio, with not a single person who had studied it, that episode exists, but I really hope that no one ever uses it as a way of either measuring the quality of my work or what exactly chaos is.
One of the things, like, for me in the mime that we do is we do various sketches. So I was trained a long time ago that you don't do a whole show of new material because that is a good way to bomb. And so individual sketches, particularly new ones, are not always a home run, if you will. Sometimes people aren't as into it. And but I don't actually, it's funny because my students would laugh at me trying to think of things that are more successful and aren't, because I actually talk about that a lot in class, is that I don't really like to think of anything as success or failure. They're just part of the journey. And if you think of, I often talk about, if you think of things as failure, then you don't necessarily thinking of them as, I mean, most of your successes come from those times that were challenging. So I don't know, but I mean, it's not quite what you're asking, but.
Yeah, I will agree with that entirely. Yeah. I've almost everything good I've ever done happened because I failed at trying to do. To me, failure just isn't a bad word. It's just, failure is just something you tried, it didn't work, and then you tried it again and again and again until it did. And the things that always taught me the most are the failures.
And one of the things in MIME is, like, we're developing new sketches right now, and the first time we do it, it won't, generally, it's not people's favorite sketch. So we will very intentionally place it between two much stronger sketches so that people aren't like, whoa, what happened to this show? And, but like I had masks made of famous mathematicians where it will be a Dell'Arte style that we've trained in, where it will be verbal. And so I have like Fermat and, you know, it was a very stormy night and I sat and I read and all this and I did it once and it was fine. But it didn't resonate with me. And so I placed it aside. Should I? I don't know. But Tanya often says that the reason I put things aside is because for me, there's a measure of the magical moment that I think can be created at least occasionally with audiences, not every time. Like we're going to perform today, you know, whatever. It'll be what it'll be. And, but if I don't see that it can be that, she notices that I move away until I begin to believe in that again. I need to believe that there can be magic in the moment. And there may or may not be, and that's okay if there's not. But I need to believe there can. And if I'm portraying a famous mathematician, I feel the load on that one more than like pulling an infinite rope. I mean, whatever. And I feel the load of representing the field, representing us as people, and representing that person. So I moved away from it. But I'll come back because it's something I very much want to do. But as an artist, I have to try new things. And I remember the first time I saw Marceau do new material, and it wasn't that great. And it was fun, but it didn't have the depth and the robustness of the other sketches. And Tanya and I turned to each other and went, wow, his sketches grow up too. And so sometimes they're failing because they're learning to walk in the sketch itself. And so, and other times just because it's just not a good idea. I mean, I did one time where I had a wall that just kept getting close, and I don't remember how it dealt with math. I mean, I don't remember. But I mean, I did it for the perfect age group. It was middle school. It was all physical comedy. And then I just started improvising and doing other things because it was just like, whoa. I mean, this, forget the math. And, I'll tell you, I know the time I had the worst bomb ever. That was hilarious. Yeah, I knew I'd think of one. All right, so I was asked to perform at a Renaissance festival. And so I'm a stage performer. I'm not a street performer at all. And you do mime, I know, but you train in these things, how to get an audience, how to keep an audience. I don't know how to do that. You sit down and now you're in my audience. And so they said, well, you come and you'll be on stage. Yeah, sure. And so I get there and they say, okay, well, we're going to put you on this little pagoda. And so it was this like circle thing with no room. And I was like, oh my goodness. And then I was at the entrance and it was high school days, 10,000 high schoolers descending on this place, walking in. Well, they're walking in and they're all cool thinking that, you know, somehow the rest of all these high schoolers are looking at them just measuring their coolness, but whatever, that's what you do. So they're moving in and I'm thinking, what in the world am I going to do to get them to look at me? Because it's basically street performing. And so I decide that I will just do highly stylized movement and then move into just illusions, because people will stop for that. If it's stylized enough, you look weird enough that you'll look, because like, what is that? And then if the illusion's strong enough, they'll stop because there's nothing there. And that's just really good illusion work. It is captivating. So I just started with that. And then I had like 100 to 150 kids standing there. I was like, there we go. And I was brought to do mime and math specifically. That's what they wanted, not mime. They wanted mime and math. So I totally had them with the mime. I was like, man, awesome. Marceau would be proud, although he doesn't like street performing. But nonetheless, he'd be proud because I used lyricism and all these techniques to do it. And then I go, how does this relate to math? So I had 150 people, 145 walked away. Like, literally, how does this relate? I mean, it was like, you know, everything I know to keep people engaged. And then five students were standing there going, yeah. So then I did it for them. You know, we had a really nice, intimate experience with the infinite rope and how it did, and I asked them the questions. But I don't know. I mean, I don't really, it just wasn't the venue for that. So that was the best I could do in that venue. And as the day went on, I did less math and did just more mime, and because I didn't know what else to do. And so someone else maybe could have done it and I would have enjoyed seeing them do it. But with my skill set, that was the best I could do. But it's a great story, so I'm glad it happened. But and it's important to remember it's all context.
Do we have questions from the audience? Sure. I'm recording this, so I'm going to want you to actually use the microphone.
It's not so much a question as an anecdote that ties together two things that Tim and Robert said. Robert talked about speaking to people in the language that they understand. And you mentioned, Tim, visual learners. So for many years, I taught a course called Symmetry and Shape, which was a gen ed course to teach geometry through art and nature. And the people in the course were primarily undergrads who were theater majors and art majors. So I had to try to find a way to reach them, because those are certainly not my fortes. But I wanted them to understand proof, and I had read about an activity somebody did. So I found three visual proofs of the Pythagorean theorem. And the Pythagorean theorem, to most people, you say theorem, they'll say Pythagorean theorem. That's the only theorem they know. But to them, it's just, as we know, a bunch of letters and numbers. But I found three visual proofs, the Chinese proof and Garfield's proof that uses a trapezoid, and I forget what the other one was. And we went through these visual proofs that are essentially dissection proofs, and assigned them to pick one, learn it, and over spring break, go home and teach it to somebody and come back and report. And the responses that they wrote in their journals when they came back were, well, they made the activity really worthwhile. I remember one girl saying that she taught it to her brother, who was a math major, and she was so thrilled that as an art major, she could teach him how to prove the Pythagorean theorem, because they'd never thought of it as a visual representation, just a set of letters that they memorized and could, you know, spout and maybe use. So it, I think it spoke to them in the language of the art and theater majors, and it also used that visual learning that you're talking about.
That's a great idea, Penny. That's a great idea for just an assignment.
Oh. They were thrilled they could teach somebody some mathematics when it wasn't something they were strong in.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a great assignment to give students in a class. Just, you can write a essay, but you could also do a painting or something like that. Oh, that would be a great way to decorate one's office when one has an office. Thank you.
So I have a question. How often, for each of you individually, do you feel like you start by thinking of a mathematical concept and then you'd like to have a way to express it? And how often are you just doing something and you think, oh, there's probably some mathematics behind this that I should incorporate?
For me, it's both. And sometimes, like recently, people will comment that, you know, they've seen the sketches we do, and when someone applies, when I do performing arts conferences, I teach classes on creativity. That's the main thing I'm brought in to do. So when somebody acts like I can't come up with a new one, Tanya always goes, oh no, now we're gonna create like five new sketches, because it just, I'm like, well, wait a minute. And, but, so I'll try to think of mathematics that I think would be helpful for people to see. And then I'm trying to figure out like a story to wrap around it, a physical experience that would kind of make that work, or how would you enact with that idea? But then other times I'm just playing with the idea that we're doing. So today in our show, Tanya will do this ball in the bag illusion, which sounds silly, but you throw a ball, and then there's a paper sack like you take a lunch in, and you can do something to it. I don't want to tell you how it works, but if you're not coming to the show and you want to know, I'll tell you. It's not that I won't tell you, but it's better not to know when you see it. And it literally looks like the ball goes in the bag. Like there's this thing you do and it just goes, and it's just, it looks completely real, like it goes in there. And we've now tied it to like something like a speedometer, so that you're picking the velocity that it goes at. But that keeps bothering me, because I'm like, I don't like the fact that we're leaning on a graph that people already know, because I'm not sure they think about that that's a graph. So it was here the other night in my room. I don't know what I was doing, but I guess maybe I was doing this guy. I don't know. But all of a sudden I went, well, what if all of a sudden we just started pulling out all the, like it almost became an improvisation of graphs. Like once people got the sketch, then we pull out another graph, but we get them to pick the speed they want to throw it at with the graph. So the graph has utility. And if you're using graphs people are used to, and if somebody doesn't know what to do, we pick it and then we throw it and then see if they can pick that up. And if they don't, then get one that they already understand. So you could move in and out of, it would be a visualization of data visualization and graphing. And will we perform that? I don't know. I mean, can we walk around with all those? And I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, in an idealized sense, we don't, you know, we can do all kinds of mime. But So that's kind of the way we tend to do it, is it just kind of moves in and out. There's some things, like I know there's a lot of rope tricks that can be quite magical that I think would blend with mime, but I don't know how yet, so.
I can tell you very precisely about the evolution of our creative process. So my co-host Annie and I, the way it goes is one of us will be reading the news or seeing an article and we'll call the other and say, oh my gosh, did you see this article about such and such? Go read it. And we'll read it. And then we'll call each other back and we'll start talking about it. And it would be an article about, I don't know, patent law or whatever the thing is. And we start having a conversation about it. The conversation gets a little bit mathematical. And then we say, wait, stop. I don't want to hear you right now. We need to turn the microphones on. I want it to be a surprise. And then we set up the microphones and then we start talking. So it feels, by construction, it's a very organic thing that we're speaking about topics of mathematical flavor. that somehow we would have been talking about anyways.
I don't professionally handle microphones at all. Clearly. Thank you all for coming. I want to thank all of my panelists, Robert Schneider, Tim Chartier,
Anna Hench.
And have a great rest of your day at JMM.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
Thanks for coming.